having me. I should say this is joint work, at least some of this is joint work with Bill Arvidsson. And if you go to the archive and look for a paper with the same title as this talk, the references of that paper have generalizations of the sorts of stuff that I'll be discussing today to perhaps more interesting cases of not just endomorphisms, but completely positive maps, and even positive maps, and not just on von Neumann algebras, but dual operator systems and fun stuff like that. You can even generalize a lot of this to semigroups, but not just single maps. I won't talk about that today. So for me, the object of interest will be a von Neumann algebra M, together with a map phi on M. It is a unital and normal star endomorphism. And today, everything in sight will be unital and normal, so I won't say that ever again. I will often drop the star. So we have an endomorphism of a von Neumann algebra, and I'm going to talk about lifting this endomorphism to an automorphism, and so I need to say what a lift is. So a lift of phi is three things, really. You have M, you've got phi already. A lift consists of another von Neumann algebra, N, and a star automorphism of it, which I'll call alpha, and then a star homomorphism, E, from N to M, making this diagram commute. So that is a lift of an endomorphism. Sometimes I will say, or might not say, reversible lift to emphasize the fact that this map alpha is invertible, but I might not. So one thing to notice about lifts is that they always exist. A trivial example, no matter what C is, you can take N to be the complex numbers, E to be the inclusion, identifying the number lambda with lambda times the unit of M, and just put the identity map up top, and there's your lift. Not a very interesting one, but it certainly is one. And one thing that I should point out is that you can generalize this and come up with a whole lot of non-trivial lifts in the following way. Instead of taking the complex numbers as my N, I could take the direct sum of the complex numbers with any von Neumann algebra I like. I'll call it N tilde. And I can put any automorphism of N tilde in there, and I can have a new thing. And I can take my E to be the same map as before, just forget that N tilde is even there. It's just as much of a lift as before. But of course, you might think of this lift as being sort of silly in that, you know, this algebra here can have a ton of structure reflected in the map beta. It can be very interesting, but it can have nothing whatsoever to do with C. And so if you want to study lifts of endomorphisms, first thing you want to do is rule out silliness like this and sort of get to the heart of things. And so what are the defects of lifts of this sort? You can characterize them in several ways. And one of them would be to say that on this algebra, we have normal linear functionals that don't factor through E in the following sense. I'm going to use square brackets to note the closed linear span of a subspace. If I look at all normal linear functionals on N of the form rho composed with E composed with alpha to the minus N, where N is an integer, and rho is normal and linear on M, I'm already forgetting my brackets. That's a set of normal linear functionals on this top algebra that sort of see stuff that has to do with this configuration. And what's wrong with this algebra here is that this space is very small. It's one-dimensional. In particular, it's not all of the pre-dual of N. Of course, in this case, with the trivial lift, which is gone, this condition holds, and it holds because N is the right size in that case. You have this very trivial thing going on, and N reflects that. A different but equivalent characterization of what's wrong with something like that is the following. If you look at the set of all elements in this top algebra N that have the property that E composed with alpha to the minus N of them is equal to zero for all N, all integers. If you look at a lift of this sort, that set is going to be huge. In particular, it's going to contain non-zero elements. Okay. And both of these conditions sort of reflect that what you've got up top is too big. You're including structure that has nothing whatsoever to do with the fact that you want things up here to reflect C. So if a lift has this property, either of these properties, we say it's degenerate. And we say lift is non-degenerate if it satisfies the negation of these properties. In other words, the only non-zero element of the top algebra that isn't seen by the bottom one through E and this action of alpha is the zero. There are no non-zero elements. And if any normal linear functional on N really is a limit of things that you can see just in terms of the action of alpha and your map E. So non-degenerate lifts are the ones you want to study. And of course, if you think about it for a moment, you can see that any lift sort of breaks up into a sum of a non-degenerate one and one that you don't care about for the purposes of lifting C. So we need to think about what non-degenerate lifts are, how to calculate them. And maybe the place to start with that is this condition here. If I have a lift that is non-degenerate, this condition is telling me that a certain map is injective. If I have this collection of alpha N and E, non-degenerate, what that means is if I take X and N and map it to the sequence E of alpha to the minus N of X, which we can regard as being just a bounded sequence of elements of M. This map is injective. My notation for the codomain here should be, let's say, little l infinity of the integers values in M. Bounded integer index sequences of elements of M. So if I have a non-degenerate lift, what I'm really talking about through this map is a set of sequences of elements of M. Although this is slightly misunderstanding things because not every sequence of elements of M that is bounded arises in this way. Sequences that come from lifts have a special property. So let's figure out what that property is. Maybe I'll just write it down. So if I have a sequence Y and it's N sequence of elements of M, and it has the property that Yn is E composed with alpha to the minus N of X. For some X, for all N, one thing you can notice about this sequence is that it has the following property. If I apply phi to any element Yn plus 1, if you use the fact that that diagram commutes, you can swap the phi and the E, and then you have an alpha and an alpha to the minus 1 canceling out. And so what you get is Yn. So you don't get arbitrary sequences of elements. You get sequences that do this. So when you have a sequence that does this, we call it definition Y satisfies that condition for all n. We say it's an inverse sequence. For phi, or if we have only one phi, we might just say it's an inverse sequence. So if you're studying non-degenerate lifts of phi, what you're really talking about is you're talking about certain sets of inverse sequences for phi. The set of all inverse sequences for phi is itself a lift in an obvious way. So I'll point that out. Maybe let's let I sub phi denote the set of inverse sequences. And I'm going to have a map E phi into M. And what's that going to do? It's going to take an inverse sequence Yn, map it to its zeroth coordinate. And if you think about what an inverse sequence is, if you write out its elements, you have y0, y1, y-1, y-2. To say the sequence is inverse means that each term is phi of its successor term. It's phi of y1, it's phi of y0, and so forth. So what that tells me is that if I shift an inverse sequence up by one and then apply E phi, it's the same thing as applying phi to the original E of the sequence. And so if I take I phi together with the map, just the shift, maybe I'll call alpha phi, which takes the sequence yn and maps it to the sequence yn minus 1. That's a reversible lift of phi. And this discussion over here shows that in some sense it is the biggest one of among non-degenerate lifts. If you have a non-degenerate lift, what you really have is you have a sub-object of this thing, this one sort of master lift that contains everything you want to know if you care about lifting phi to an automorphism. So this lift is given a special name, which I can't really justify here. It's called the asymptotic lift. Definition, this alpha phi, E phi, to be asymptotic. And that's really for reasons that I haven't explained. The way I've characterized I phi is it's sort of the maximal non-degenerate lift that you can have. There are other ways of characterizing that particular lift of phi in ways that don't make reference to inverse sequences. If you start with that other condition that I erased for non-degeneracy in terms of normal linear functionals, you can get a normal linear functionals characterization of this lift. And there are other sort of interpretations and ways that refer to the asymptotic behavior of this path alpha that justify the name. In any case, it's the sort of the lift of phi that you want to study if you want to lift phi to automorphisms. One thing that's kind of interesting about this association is we started with a star endomorphism. We sort of have this canonically defined star automorphism associated to it. And if you want to formalize that, you can turn it into a functor from the category of star endomorphisms with equivariant star homomorphisms as the arrows to star automorphisms. And it's kind of interesting because a lot of the ways that people have of taking sort of non-reversible objects and turning them into reversible ones aren't obviously functorial or only become so after you make an appropriate choice of representation or invariant state. Here we don't need to assume anything like that. We can always just write down this particular reversible lift of phi. You can sort of think of alpha phi as the automorphism that phi is trying to be as hard as possible. So now I guess what we want to get to in the remaining brief bit of time is how we can understand this asymptotic lift in terms of properties of the original map phi. So the place to start with that is maybe just looking again at this characterization of it in terms of inverse sequences. The thing to notice about these inverse sequences is that elements in them, for instance, y0, if yn is an inverse sequence, y0 is phi of y1. It's also phi squared of y2, phi cubed of y3. Every element of this sequence is phi to the n of something in M. So notice an inverse sequence for phi is not just an inverse sequence with values in M, but it actually takes values, we'll call the tail algebra M sub infinity, which is the intersection of the ranges of all of the powers of phi. And if I look at the restriction of phi to this algebra, it's surjective. So if you look at inverse sequences for the restriction of phi and inverse sequences for the original phi, you're talking about the same set. You're talking about the same lift. So what that tells us is that if you're interested in the asymptotic lift of phi, you can assume by passing to its restriction, by passing to M infinity, we can assume that phi is surjective. We can understand any asymptotic lift in terms of the asymptotic lift of a surjective star endomorphism. And of course, if phi is then injective as well, it's an automorphism, by this definition, it's pretty clear then that the asymptotic lift of phi is just a fee itself. So the interesting case arises when this fee has a kernel. So if fee has a kernel, what can we say about I fee? And this is kind of cute. It's a lot like the decomposition of an isometry on a Hilbert space into its pure part and its unitary part. What we'll see is that if you have a surjective star endomorphism of a von Neumann algebra, it breaks naturally up into an automorphism and something of a very simple type. So we have phi. It is now surjective. What we're going to do is we're going to consider the, for each n, consider the kernel of phi to the n. What is that? It is a ultra-weakly closed, two-sided ideal in M. These things increase with N. And one thing you can say, of course, because it's a two-sided ideal in a von Neumann algebra, is that it's of a particular simple form. It's of the form CNM for some projection, central projection in M. And because these kernels are increasing within, the sequence of projections is increasing. And of course, if you have an increasing sequence of projections, it converges to something, another projection, which we'll call C. If you look at the sequence of kernels, you get a sequence of projections that increases to C. You can easily check that because phi here maps the kernel of phi to the n plus 1 to the kernel of phi to the n. Phi takes these projections. Phi takes cn plus 1 to cn. And in particular, that tells you that if you look at what happens to c here, phi fixes c. So you have a central projection that's fixed by phi. So the action of phi on m splits up. So phi, it splits into the action of phi on C perp M and an action just on this part where we have the kernel. And of course, if you look at the restriction of phi to C perp of M, it's a surjective star endomorphism because the original phi was assumed to be. And it has no kernel anymore. We took it away. So this is an automorphism. So phi is an automorphism on this sum end of M. And it's doing something else on the other sum end of it. So if you like, this is the, it's like the unitary part of an isometry. And what we've got over here is going to be the pure part. So we just need to understand, if you like, if you have a surjective star endomorphism, it's normal, a von Neumann algebra, and it has the property that the sequence of its kernels exhausts the space, what is that? Well, what is that, what is that map really doing? And it's rather simple. What we'll do here, we'll just set up some nice coordinates for understanding this map. We have this increasing sequence of projections C. We can make it a total sequence of mutually orthogonal central projections. We can write it as C1 plus C2 minus C1 plus C3 minus C2, and so on. And correspondingly, any element of M, or any element of CM, splits up into a sum x1 plus x2 plus x3 and so forth, with xn being in that corresponding sum end of m. And if you look at what phi x is, its decomposition is related to this one in a very simple way. Its first component is just going to be phi of x2. And its second component is going to be phi of x3. So if you like, what we're doing here is we're just shifting the sequence over one, and then we're applying phi. And you can even sort of untwist that shifting by noticing the following fact. I mean, this isn't quite a shift because each of these xi's lies in a different algebra. And they only become coherent if you sort of apply phi to them. One thing you can notice here, though, is if you take phi for any n bigger than 1, phi to the n minus 1 is going to map cn minus 1 m, just to c1 of m, which is, of course, the kernel of phi. It restricts to a map of this chunk of m to the kernel of phi. And if you notice that we've sort of taken away any possible kernel it might have, this is actually an isomorphism. And so instead of thinking of x, an element of Cm, as a sequence with each value in a different algebra, using these isomorphisms, we can think of an element of Cm just as a sequence of elements in the kernel of phi. And if you look at what the action of phi is doing in these coordinates, it's just a shift. So the conclusion is that if you take phi and you just restrict it to the sum n that has all the kernel in it, this is conjugate to the map that takes x1, x2, blah, 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 and shifts it over by 1 on the von Neumann algebra, just consisting of bounded natural number index sequences of elements, not of M, but of the kernel of phi. So any normal star endomorphism of a von Neumann algebra that happens to be surjective is conjugate to an automorphism plus a shift. If you want to understand what the asymptotic lift of phi is, you just need to understand what the asymptotic lift of a shift is. And if you think about what inverse sequences for that map look like, you can see that the lift of the shift sort of the unilateral shift, and to make it an automorphism, you just turn it into the bilateral shift. And so it's going to be acting on integer index sequences of elements in the kernel of phi, just shifting them one over. And the projection map will just be truncation, cutting off the negative chunk. So that's how you lift a shift endomorphism. And that's, in general, how you lift any endomorphism to an automorphism. There's much more to be said, but I'll just stop now. Thanks. Absolutely, right. Yeah, I don't know what you would do if phi wasn't normal.
Have you thought about putting lifts in the endomorphism lifts in between?
Oh, you mean stacking them up?
Stacking them up, some kind of a Martingale lift.
Yeah, you can. That's a natural way of looking at some of these processes, because really what I've done is that, if you like, I started with a general phi, and then I restricted it to its tail algebra. And then, you know, I could sort of envision each of these reductions as adding another ladder, and then there's little theorems that tell you along the way the asymptotic lift of this map is what you get at the top. And you can do that kind of thing. It's actually very helpful to sort of keep track of the ideas, to think in those sort of towers. Yeah? Help me to do what? Oh, right. Okay, yeah. Actually, I'd never thought of that, but that sounds like something I should go and do. Right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Have you thought about the continuous object analog for this? I mean, in the case of...
For one parameter?
Right.
There's similar things you can do actually with any commutative embeddable SIMI group defining the asymptotic lift. And it has certain properties that I didn't explore. Where the difficulty arises is sort of reducing things to just a shift on one algebra, because most SIMI groups don't have one minimal element. They have many or none. And so what you end up getting instead of a shift on something like this is you get some kind of shift on a bundle, where over each fiber you have a different algebra. And it's not as slick, at least the way I tried to do it. I don't know.